This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. What would you like to get off your chest? Are you holding on to secrets, fears, or frustrations? We all carry around different stressors, both big and small. Don't keep it all bottled up inside. Therapy is a safe space to get things off your chest and work through whatever is weighing you down. It's also a great way to learn to resolve conflict, change negative thought patterns, and more. If you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online and designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Get it off your chest with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/BeHereNow today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/BeHereNow.
Welcome to Conda Mason's Brown Rice Hour, a podcast that quilts together a fabric of connection between land, race, money, culture, and spirit. Discover a connection that engages with the most inspiring and cutting-edge thought leaders today, pointing toward our collective healing and liberation. If you are interested in supporting the Brown Rice Hour, please visit BeHereNowNetwork.com/Conda.
So, welcome everyone. We are back with the Brown Rice Hour. Thank you for watching this podcast or listening to this podcast, however it's coming towards you. This is where we have conversations at the intersection of land, race, money, culture, and spirit. My name is Conda Mason, and I am the host of the Brown Rice Hour. And we have a very special guest with us today, a dear, dear friend and colleague, Ms. Noliwe Alexander. And Noliwe is the executive director of Peace at Any Pace and a core facilitator for the flagship program, Deep Time Liberation, as well as an upcoming program called the Elder and Alumni Programs. So we want to thank you, Noli, for being here. Welcome.
Thanks so much. I have been looking forward to it. Really looking forward to it. It's good.
This is so good. It's so good to have you. It's so good to have you. We have spent so much time together in different spaces, but to have you on my podcast is just super special for me.
Yeah, you're my girl. I mean, I miss you. Miss you here in Oakland.
I know. I'm not in Oakland anymore. As a matter of fact, Speaking of that, I wanted to begin by a little bit of setting up a little sacred space and thinking about the land that we're on right now. And as you indicated, I am not in Oakland anymore. I'm actually in Louisiana, which was the unceded territory of the Choctaw people. And so where are you right now, Noli?
Well, I'm in East Oakland, and it is the Chichenyo unceded Ohlone territory. And, you know, it's so funny. We're doing a lot of honoring of the land.
Yeah.
And I actually began to feel it was getting to be a little trite. So I needed to actually find out who these people were, who is this tribe. And I have such a connection with them, even though I don't know them, but I feel the energy of them. I mean, they were sacred people. They loved the water and they, you know, they loved ritual. And that's something I'm really working with land honoring. So, and they were storytellers. And so it just feels good to be able to honor them in that way, these Ohlone people. And they were all over this Northern California, this area from pretty much Sacramento down to San Jose. You know, this is a big tribe.
Big tribe.
Yeah.
You know, I always think about what it must have been like to just be on that, because the Bay Area is so gorgeous, and to just be there in the early days of just, you know, indigenous people being there on that beautiful, it's just so gorgeous. I can only imagine. I think about that, like when prior to any colonialism and it being built up, what it must have been like in the Bay Area then.
Yeah. And we still have tribes who are active here.
Yeah.
And so they're trying to restore their language and really come together because there are different tribal fractions within the Ohlone tribe. And so they're really trying to bring their people back together again. And I did this little history of their population. And in 1770, there were like 20,000. And as of 2010, there was 3,800. I mean, the diminishing of the people, and yet they're still coming back together again, which I think is just a huge testament.
Well, I think the land back movement, too, is really strong in the Bay Area.
I'm
familiar with land back that has been given back to the Ohlone. And so it's also that movement, because of the politics of the Bay Area, is so strong, and it's just wonderful to see what's happening there with honoring the indigenous people and literally giving their land back. So
I know some people who've actually put it in their will that they will give their homes back, the entire property that they're on. Yeah, so
do it. Give it back.
Yeah.
Give it back.
Yeah. It's not ours to hold.
No. And so I want to begin with a little bio and let people know, let them know who you are. I mean, they're already getting a sense of the depth of who you are. And so I'm going to read the bio, if you don't mind.
That's fine.
Okay, so Noliwe Alexander. She's been a student of Vipassana meditation for close to 25 years. And throughout this time of deep devotion to the Dharma, Noliwe has become a dedicated practitioner, a meditation teacher of various retreats and sitting groups. She does day-longs and class series programs as well. Noli is also has dedicated much of her Buddha Dharma practice and teachings to the BIPOC, LGBTQIA+, at-risk and elder communities. She is a graduate of the Spirit Rock CDL 4 program of East Bay Meditation Center, which is in Oakland, California, Commit to Dharma program in 2010, and is a graduate, a proud graduate, of Spirit Rock's teacher training from 2017 to 2020, which we were compadres in. We both graduated from that program together.
Yeah.
So Noliwe is the founder of Peace at Any Pace, Inc., a nonprofit organization that offers a journey to healing from intergenerational and ancestral trauma retreats and elder and youth programs as well, which are exclusively for people from the African diaspora. Noliwe is a wisdom keeper and humbled by the presence of her ancestor spirit that lives within and walks besides her. Thank you, Noli.
Oh, thanks, Conda. Boy, listen to that.
I know, right? There's a lot there. And there's so much that I want to get into, so many parts of your life. Mm-hmm. And I want to start with a question that I always start with. And now you've watched my broadcast. You've listened to it.
I have heard him,
And I think you know what that first question is.
I do. And I've been thinking about it.
And I bet you came prepared.
And as they say, I'm always born ready.
You were born ready. So, okay. So the first question, and you know, there's a reason why I asked this question, because it really not only is, you know, the brown rice hour about food and all of that. And you know, it brown rice changed my life, but the answer to this question tells a lot about a person, a family, how they grew up, where they grew up, how they grew up. You get a sense of time and space. And it's very interesting what I actually glean out of this question. So here's the question. What was your comfort food as a child, and who prepared it for you?
Right. You know, I've been thinking about this, girl. I have been thinking about it because, like, what was it? And it was so easy. It came up so quickly. And my grandmother, Nana, she originally was from Birmingham, Alabama, and then migrated to Pueblo, Colorado. And she raised five children during the Depression. She was a domestic, but she always had a garden. And we would visit her occasionally as a child, but when she and her husband, my papa, when they moved to California, they moved to Inglewood. And so it was real close to where we were, right, in L.A.
Yeah.
And they had a house that was big enough for a garden. And every time I go over there, it was honestly, it's the greens.
The greens.
The greens.
What kind of greens?
Collard greens. She'd mix a little bit of mustard greens in there.
Okay.
And it was like she just slapped something on it. You know, it wasn't anything I could specifically say how she cooked it.
Right.
But it was what she put on it.
What did she put on it?
That's what I'm saying. I don't know what it is, but she slapped some goodness on it.
Goodness. You
know, goodness on it.
Lord,
and I would come over and I would just get, my whole plate would be full of her greens. And then the other thing is that she would make monkey bread. You know what monkey bread is?
Monkey bread.
Oh, and I would watch her.
Tell the people about monkey bread, please.
Monkey bread is nothing but dough, right?
It's dough.
But it's dough and butter. And she would have it's almost like a bundt pan. And she would take these rounds and make the dough and slap it in the butter and then layer it.
Yes.
Put it in the oven. And I would be like this waiting for it to come out.
The smell of the monkey bread, too. Remember that?
Fresh bread, fresh butter bread. And then I would just you could just peel layers off, layers upon layers. It was so good. Oh, my God. And so, you know, those are the things I look forward to when I went over there. And then when I got to be in college, high school and college, I would call her up. Mm-hmm. And I'd say, Nana, I'm coming over. She goes, okay. And by the time I got there, there was a pot of greens ready for me. She just knew.
I love it. And so what's your relationship now to collard greens? And
I make them all the time.
Do you? How do you make them?
I make them now I'm a vegan. And so I make them with no meat, no turkey, no nothing, but just vegetable broth. I oftentimes put a jalapeno pepper in there.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And sometimes a little bit of carrots. But I cook them in onions and garlic, of course, garlic. Yeah, and I cook them down and cook them down. I don't cook them so much that they're mush, but I cook them down. And we have them probably about twice a month.
I go out
and get bundles of them and just make them. Yes. We're growing some right now in the garden.
Yes, yes.
Yeah.
It's the staple.
And it's a memory, you know, that I can recall. Yes. And my mother wasn't really the best cook, honestly. Mm-hmm. My dad learned from my Nana, his mother. So he would make one last thing I want to tell you. He would make oxtail.
Oxtail.
Oxtail. And, you know, I don't eat meat now, but I can still feel the sensation in my mouth.
Right in the back.
Right there. And I could, you know, he would. And there's not a lot of meat on the oxtail.
No, right? It's a tail. Come on.
It's a tail. But whatever meat there was, it would be falling off.
But this is what you have to remember. All the food that our ancestors ate, the meat, was very little meat on it because we didn't get the good part.
We
got the tail. We got the ears. We got the feet. Right? We got the nose. We got all those places.
We got the intestines.
Oh, Lord. Well, let's not talk about that. We got all the places where there was little meat. And so what would happen, though, is that the kind of seasoning and how our folks would season it, right, is just so good.
Oh, and, I can still... all of those things, when I thought about it before this podcast, it all came up again for me. It's a sensation in my mouth.
Yeah.
And then it just opened my heart up again.
Right? And that's what, you know, is so interesting how the conversation of food, or sometimes when it's the opposite of that, and, you know, you were raised with canned beans and nobody really cooked. And what does that, you know, where that memory, what that jogs within you. So it's an interesting question. And I love food. And I love the way it, I do. I love it.
I know.
I grow it. I cook it, you know. And I love the way it tells the story of a family. You know,
and it also, it brings up a memory of gratitude.
Yeah.
For me.
Yeah.
You know, that I can be grateful that we had it. We didn't have a lot. But what we were always taken care of with our food.
Yeah.
We never lacked in food.
Yeah.
And it was made in these particular ways and made to stretch, you know.
Made to stretch, girl.
Yeah, we could. Yeah.
We didn't one meal could stretch. But it stretched.
It's stretched.
You know, my grandparents had a little tiny little farm, and it was, probably it was less than an acre, probably a third of an acre. And they had cows and chickens and turkeys and pigs, and then the vegetable part. And we had to grow our food because we didn't, my family, we didn't have a lot of capital at all. You know, we didn't have money, but we were food secure because we had access and we grew our own. Right. And they would slaughter the animals and put them, we had big freezers, and so it would last all year long. And then my grandparents and my parents did this every year. You know, they would go in together and do this. Wow. And it actually made me a vegetarian.
That's a lot of meat, huh?
I couldn't stand the killing of the animals. Oh my God. It was pretty traumatic for me. I still think I need to go to therapy about it, but it did make us food secure, and my family ate well because we had that.
You know? And there's a sense of not lacking.
Yeah.
You know, maybe there was, you know, different dysfunction going on in the family, because I had that as well, or whatever it might be. But there was, you're right, that food security made it feel like there was love.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. You know, I have
and especially when it's made with love.
Oh, gosh. Oh, gosh. You know, I have to say one little thing, too, is that I never asked myself this question. But since we're talking about it, there's a sense of my memory of my grandmother, who obviously was, well, not obviously, but was, you know, a Black woman. She made tamales. We grew up at the border of California and Mexico, right at the border in a little town called El Centro. And then we migrated a little north to the San Bernardino area. And my grandmother made tamales. And I have memories of this big pot with steam coming out of it and the husk, you know, and the masa. And me and my sister, you know, there in the kitchen and just eating. She'd give us the, you know, she'd give us the husk and we just like eat off of it. But she made tons and tons of tamales. She even sold them. I mean, my grandmother made tamales like nobody's business, man. We grew up very Mexican and Black, like Southern Black diet and the Mexican diet. Yeah.
Where was she originally from?
She was actually from Texas. So
Texas. Okay. There again.
Yeah. Which is really Mexico.
By another name. And another occupier. Right?
That's right. Another occupier, another name, another false border. So she grew up in Mexico. Yeah. So anyway, this is so much fun. I can talk forever about this.
Oh, like, God. And I'm hungry now.
I know. Should we just cut it off right here and come back? Let's go eat and then come back. Do another session. My God. I have so much to talk to you about. And so I guess we'll get to it. You know, I think in your bio, Nola, you talk about being 25 years as a Dharma practitioner. So when I do the calculations, I know you're not 26 or 27 years old. So I don't know. I mean, I know that's not.
Yeah.
And so I know that you didn't start there with the Dharma.
Right.
I'm wondering, were you raised in the any particular Black theological tradition? And when and how did you turn toward the Buddha Dharma?
Oh, good question. That's a really good question. You know, I was raised a United Methodist.
Okay.
Very, very different than Baptist, AME. It was, you know, the hymns were, you know, like that. It wasn't, you know, didn't have gospel. Didn't have gospel music or whatever. But my family, my grandmother, my father, my mother later converted to born again, and then she was Baptist. But that's how I grew up until I was about 12. And we went to church every Sunday. We went to Bible study. We went to church, summer church school or whatever it was.
You like it?
I liked it until I was about 12. Mm-hmm. And then I started to question. Mm-hmm. That's when my mind began to question, what is this about? It was maybe about 11, actually. And it was like I wasn't being able to really put together who these prophets were and why we were supposed to, you know, honor them or live for them or why they died for us, quote unquote.
Sure.
So at that point in time, there was a shift that happened in my family in the dynamic where my mother, my parents divorced when I was 10. Then my mother moved up to Northern California. My sister and I stayed and lived with my father. Which
was
where?
In Colorado?
In Los Angeles.
In Los Angeles, okay.
Yeah, so we had been living in South LA. And my dad was living in the San Fernando Valley, so we went to move to the Valley with him. Okay. By that time, I had stopped going to church. Something wasn't interesting me.
Okay.
So when I went to junior high school, it was called junior high school then, now it's middle school. But when I went to junior high school, I got turned on to a couple things that started my inward journey, actually. When I was 13, I read Hermann Hesse's Siddhartha.
Oh, gosh, yeah.
And that began this inner journey for me to recognize that there was something greater than myself.
Do you remember who gave you that book?
I do. It was a kid at school. His name was Alan, if I can recall. Okay. Yeah. And there was a bunch of kids who were reading really esoteric books, right? And so then I began to read all of Hermann Hesse's books, The Glass Bead Game, Magister Luddite, Damien, all of that. But and then when I was about in ninth grade, I guess it was, I started reading the autobiography of Malcolm X. Mm-hmm. And I got angrier and angrier and angrier. And here I was in this school that I just kept looking at these people, looking at them like they were the white devil. Right. My father kind of went, okay, let me temper this. This is his thought, I think. And he handed me Khalil Gibran's The Prophet. Mm. So I had read Siddhartha, I had read Malcolm X, and now I've got The Prophet. Mm-hmm. And he said, you need this for balance.
Beautiful.
And so that began a journey inward. And I have gone from, in the 70s, this is my first introduction to meditation was through Transcendental Meditation, TM. It didn't quite stick with me. I did other types of inquiries, spiritual inquiry. And it led me to doing more meditation when I moved back to Colorado. As an adult, and moved and lived off the land and lived in a community and so forth. We did a lot of meditation and yurts and teepees and all of that. And when I moved back again back to the north, to the Bay Area, I was introduced to insight meditation, Vipassana. Yeah. And our dear friend Ruth King, actually.
Ah, okay. Okay.
She said, why don't you come to a POC retreat at Spirit Rock? And there I was.
Bingo. You know.
Bingo. Yeah, I think it was in 2000, but I had already been doing, you know, quite a bit of meditation well before that. And
which POC retreat was it? That was like about the second or third?
It was the second one. Yeah, the second one. Yeah, yeah. So...
And that's
where we met and been on that land, you know, in that institution for over 20 years now.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. So. That's amazing. And so what was it about insight that felt like, yeah, this is the one for me?
I think it was identifying with my suffering. That I had skirted over it. You know, I had been doing a lot of different work, whether it was through different type of mediums and Seth and Jane Roberts and Edgar Cayce and other types of spirit work, land work. But I'd been skirting over the fact that I was actually suffering.
Yeah.
I could pinpoint everyone else's. Mm-hmm. And when I realized that the extent of my suffering stemmed from my own attachment to the outcome of my life, and that happened in that second retreat, it fundamentally changed me.
The second Vipassana retreat that you took?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. What was it? Do you remember the which retreat?
Well, it was at POC.
The POC retreat.
Yeah.
I see. Wow. Yeah. Interesting.
I really got that this was housed in my body.
Yeah.
And in my mind.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm. It was profoundly life-shifting. You know, it shape-shift me, you know.
Yeah.
Into wanting more, wanting to know more, wanting to practice more.
Do you remember what your aha moment was in that retreat? Was there one particular thing or just a culmination of all of
it? I think it was that place of what we call greed, attachment. And I remember we were so small, we just had little councils at the end of the day, right? And we would have a talking stick, which was a microphone. We went around and I waited till the last person in the last evening to take the talking stick. And I talked about what was going on, what I was viscerally feeling, what was had arisen for me.
Yeah.
And I was weeping. And, you know, it wasn't just crying. It was that ugly cry, that boo,
that's ugly.
And then pretty soon after I was doing that, there was this. Oops. It was over. And I hadn't finished processing it all, right? I was still weeping. And so I walked into the bathroom. And this is what really, the other thing that got me hooked. I walked right outside into the women's bathroom and was kind of hovered in the corner crying. And three women walked up to me. And one was Shahar Godfrey, ancestor. Another one was Olivia, ancestor. And the other one was Alice Walker. And they held me like a baby. And they allowed me to continue to weep.
Yeah.
And I realized that this is who we are as people of culture.
Yeah.
We're not going to follow those same mores of going into a retreat center that is so westernized that says you don't touch, you don't look, you don't comfort. And I really received what I needed. And these three women will forever be my angels. So that's how I came to the Dharma in this way. Yeah. And I think the Dharma has always been in my life because I've always been a seeker.
Yeah. And it sounds to me like the work that you are doing now with your nonprofits feels like it's a continuation of that. How many years ago? What year was that?
2000.
2000. That was
21 years ago.
And it feels like there's this, I absolutely see the thread of what you just spoke of and the work that you're doing right now. Now that you've graduated and you've done all the different trainings and you've been teaching forever and you've been doing incredible, you know, all kinds of teaching and you still do. But now, in addition to all of that, you have created two nonprofits that are jumping off from this source that you just described. And they're so beautiful, Noli Way. They're so beautiful. And I really want to talk about that.
Great. Thank
Peace
you.
At any pace. Peace at any pace. First of all, I love the name. Peace at any pace. And I'm going to just quickly read the mission statement, if you don't mind, so that people know what it is. The mission of Peace at Any Pace is to offer healing opportunities through culturally specific journeys, genealogical mapping, storytelling, drumming, and mindful awareness to multi-generational people of the African diaspora who suffer from the impact of intergenerational and ancestral trauma. Peace at Any Pace facilitates national and international classes, retreats, and sojourns to bridge ancestral histories to present-day experiences, transforming wounds to wisdom, leading to deep time liberation, which we'll talk about soon. So I love what you're saying here and the work that this is doing. And, you know, something that you said that I want to shine a light on, I want to lift up on, you said in that bathroom, three women came up to you and they hugged you and they held you and they gave you what you needed. A typical Vipassana meditation retreat, you don't do that. You're in silence. Somebody's doing the thing. You let them do it. You said, no, that's not who we are. That's not what you needed. That silence. So there's this merging that is happening with African diasporic tradition, cultural spiritual traditions and the Dharma. And what you're doing at Peace at Any Pace feels like this beautiful, beautiful integration. You want to shine some light on that?
Yeah, thank you. You know, you oftentimes speak of intersection. Mm-hmm. You know, when you begin with the Brown Rice Hour, it's the intersection. Yeah. This is what I feel Peace at Any Pace is doing. It's intersecting the trauma of our histories and our present moment to being held with such tenderness and grace. Because what we do with Peace at Any Pace and Deep Time Liberation is the ground in which we're working from is also a place of compassion and loving kindness and equanimity and most of all, joy. You know, we don't leave these sojourns and these experiences without that tangible sense that we are resilient.
Yeah.
And just with the healing touch of another, the listening touch of another, the heart opening of another, we can begin to create and cultivate this healing power. And from that, there's a portal to joy and to wellness.
Yeah.
You know, there's so many more people of culture coming into these halls of meditation. Mm-hmm. And because of the Western psychology and the way Western Dharma has been landscaped, it has said to many people, sit there and be with what's coming up. And sometimes in that silence, because what is happening in our bodies as people from the African diaspora, we have so much that's arising. It's not just the irritation of somebody else in the room. It is the histories and the herstories that are starting to show their face. And our hope is that we can begin to bridge that, begin to allow for the non-reactive self to show up, because we're actually becoming more and more in touch with our ancestral history and the ancestral trauma that we have endured, and yet we have survived. But we need to know it, witness it, be the ones that are able to say, and through kind of that equanimous mind, is to be able to say, and I see this. This is the intersection. And we do it through this deep dive into calling in your ancestors. Who are they? Mm-hmm. Call their name. Witness them. We drum them in. We ask them to hold this space for us. And then we begin to look at these places in which we're frayed. And we do this incredible mapping that takes us into your genealogical history. And the legends of these are not necessarily, here's my family tree, but things that are specific to our lineage and who we are. Mm-hmm. Have you been affected by addiction? Have you been affected by the clansmen taking over your property historically? Mm-hmm. Have you been taken over by police violence? Have you been abandoned? Have you lived in poverty? Those types of things. What is the mental illness that may have been in your family? Mm-hmm. As people from the African diaspora, because of our conditioning, we've held secrets. In that, that holds the trauma in our body. That's where we hold it. That's how and that's how we thought we survived. And yet it created more and more disease. So we're trying to unearth that in these in this work that we're doing. And it's powerful work.
It's
we see it.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, in the mission, you say that people of the African diaspora who suffer from the impact of intergenerational and ancestral trauma. I'm wondering, how does one know that? I mean, people are living their lives here, being impacted by things day to day, the racism that's institutional, that shows up in so many ways. And then just being a human in general is hard.
Right.
How does one know that this is trauma and this is ancestral trauma. How is that revealed?
Well, it's revealed through these particular exercises that we do, these ways in which you can map your history and your family. Remembering, you know, that's one of the things that we just have to do. We have to remember to remember.
Okay.
What did your grandmother say? Mm-hmm. What did they live through? What did your grandmother tell you about her mother mm-hmm. and what they had to live through? Because oftentimes, especially in 2021, when a lot of people saying, I'm traumatized, some of it is not their trauma. It's vicarious trauma. It's the trauma that has laid within their cellular memory. That's what's showing up.
You're talking about the collective trauma?
It's collective trauma and it's individual trauma as well.
Okay.
So-and-so traumatized me. But why did they traumatize you? What was the spark? What was the trigger? And maybe it's actually rooted deeper and deeper than what we even know.
Yeah.
And those cellular memories, that place in which we hold the ways in which we are, mm-hmm. tend to not be looked at, tend to be discarded. And what happens is we begin to look at what's happening now instead of looking at what has happened in the past. And I think that there's something so very rich around where are we holding fear? Where are we internalized all of that? Our rage, our hatred. This is real. And it may not come from us, but it may come from a history mm-hmm. of it happening within our family unit or within the collective people in which we have had to live in our society and the conditions. Let's be faith. Let's real get real.
Yeah.
The conditions that we've had to live in.
And so
when we started this, we started to do this for all people of color.
Mm-hmm.
These exercises, these sojourns, these programs. And we realized that we didn't know what we didn't know. I couldn't address what happened to the immigrant Latinx community or to the Chinese American API community. But what I could address, because this is what I know and the secrets that we have held in my own family, I could do it for those from the African diaspora. And that's what our team and our organization is about.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting because also when I look at the mission of, Deep Time Liberation, first of all, that's, you know, love the name again, Deep Time Liberation. I'm going to read a little bit about what you have on your website. Okay, you have Deep Time Liberation delves into the exploration of how our ancestral legacy and historical beliefs influence our present lives. Once we understand the need for committing to our individual and collective healing, the pathway to healing appears. We can then recognize and acknowledge the experiences and history clouding our perceptions, causing us to continually cause harm to ourselves and others because of our reactions. Identifying the genesis of our suffering comes in part from the intergenerational and vicarious traumas, which you just spoke of, known or unknown, past or present. The attachments, the delusion, and the aversion that we've experienced blocks the portal to healing. And the way out is through the recognition and honoring of our historical harm. Deep Time Liberation will engage you in rituals, storytelling, drumming, and discovery through the lens of insight meditation practices. You know, when I read that, Noli Way, I can read it with two minds. I read it as a Black woman, and I feel like liberation is possible. I feel like it's an invitation. You're giving me an invitation to heal and to liberate myself from my own, from the stories, whether known or unknown, that are lodged within me. And we know that they're bad. We know what happened with slavery in America. We know what chattel slavery was like. And so we know that there's got to be stuff there. At the same time, I can read that as the human being, okay? And I think that I wish white body people had the same kind of program for them, separate from what, you know, what mm-hmm. you're doing with the African diaspora. But it speaks to, as I read it, the fact that the legacy and the history of harm and healing and the clouding perceptions that, you know, was causing, you know, the harm to ourselves and to each other and the suffering. I mean, delusion, attachment, aversion, all of that. It feels to me like if there was a tandem program for white-bodied people mm-hmm. to go through, to also dig through, because they've got to do it too. Because we're
exactly.
If we don't all do it, then do this deep work, then we're still here on this finite, beautiful, you know, spaceship Earth, mm-hmm. bumping up against each other,
right.
traumatizing each other. And the lack of the de-traumatization of white-bodied people is an important aspect for us as well. What do you think
and
about
that? I think you're absolutely correct. And I know that Resma is doing some work with white-body individuals and bodies of culture and color. But I think that what happens if we don't do it together, independently.
Oh, yeah.
really, we're not going to do it together. But there is the continual blaming the other, instead of really looking so deeply inside ourselves, because it is not a pretty look sometimes.
Right? Yeah.
It's not pretty to understand what even our ancestors went through. It's painful to relive the pictures and to actually reprogram ourselves from our own stories. For white-bodied individuals, this work is essential.
Yeah.
I'm not confident that the majority of white-bodied individuals want to do this work. Because I think that there is this place of delusion. You said the word.
Oh, yeah. It's too much. I mean, you know, they're still trying to understand, so many people, white-bodied people, trying to even believe that, you know, racism still exists in America. Although I think that, you know, the most recent horrible murder of George Floyd kind of opened that, you know, kind of buried that delusion. But I don't, yeah, this is deep work for everybody. I mean, you know, African diasporic people to want to do this work is a big lift, because it also allows someone, like you said, when, you know, to liberate oneself means I'm letting go of a story that actually gives me comfort, even mm-hmm. if it's a negative story,
mm-hmm.
right? Even if it's a story of sorrow and woe and suffering, I hold on to it, and it's a comfort. There's like this blanket.
Exactly.
If I have to get rid of that blanket and actually look at, you know, what's happening with myself, my ancestry, and all of that. I mean, that's a lot for anybody, Noreen.
That's a lot. And we have to hold that, which is why we have such a small group to gathering every time.
Perfect.
We don't want 100 people.
Yeah,
we can't hold the energy of what's arising. And one of the things I just want to say about Deep Time Liberation and all the other programs of Peace at Any Pace, there's no guarantee for liberation. Not for an individual, not for the collective. But what there is the possibility of it.
Yeah. Possibility.
And that's even why I stayed in Buddhism at this point. There's no guarantee that I'm going to be quote unquote free from my own suffering.
Right.
But there's a possibility of it if I do the work.
Right.
And what we ask of people is to show up, mm-hmm. open and do the work, and actually to take the crust that has formed around your heart.
Mm-hmm.
And begin to let that crust go and open your heart and be willing to have faith
mm-hmm.
in this process and this program that mm-hmm. you're going to be able to come out of the other side of it.
Yeah.
And again, no guarantees, but the possibility of going through that portal to healing, it's there.
Yeah.
Deep Time Liberation is, it's a powerful formula. what we're doing is powerful.
Yeah.
And I just want to give a shout out to the facilitators.
Oh, please. Yeah. Let's talk.
We've got Devin Barry, who helped form this together, and he's doing incredible work.
Devin Barry.
Yeah. Big bows. Big bows. Devin is... He's rock solid. Yeah. And we have been doing this together since its very inception. He came back. He did this work. He came back. He actually went to a plantation and did metta. He went to the plantation. Actually, he visited where his people were enslaved, his family.
Yeah.
So he has been doing this for such a long time. We then created Deep Time Liberation and began to bring it forward. We invited Rosetta Saunders in, who's an educator of over 25 years and who's doing some deep, deep rooted work in African ancestry and is a drummer. And so knowing how to call in through the drum, the talking drum, the djembe, calling in the ancestors to be held, and then doing her own work along the path of understanding where the secrets and the suffering lied in her family. And then we called in Dara Williams, who is a Buddhist practitioner, but also a trauma therapist, and has a deep, deep relationship to people in that level of suffering. And these are the four of us, and we have other wonderful board of directors and supporting staff. This is an organization right now that is, it's now, it's happening now. It's on the precipice to really making some change occur.
Yeah.
And I couldn't be more proud.
Yeah. And me, so much proud about you too, Lily Way. You have created something out of your own experience. I mean, they say that the best work, business work or whatever, however it manifests itself, nonprofit, for profit, is doing the work that you know inside yourself. And so you clearly, just starting from, again, from the very beginning, talking about, you know, how you started on the path, and you've connected the dots. You've created something out of nothing. And I'm so proud of what you're doing and so interested in being able to do a journey sometime with you. It's incredible. And I'm curious, for those who have attended so far, how many journeys have you done so far? And, and what, tell us a little bit about them. And also, what has been the result from people afterwards?
Yeah. Oh, thank you. That's a great question. We've done one in-person journey. We've done some individual journeys for ourselves in order to really, you know, you can't teach what you don't know.
Right.
So we've done some journeys ourselves. We've done one in-person journey, and then we got thwarted with the pandemic. And so, there it was. It kind of took us away. We have just, we had to re-plan and reorganize ourselves and write a whole new curriculum to bring it online.
To bring it online, yes.
Yeah. And we didn't know if it was going to work. And it worked beautifully.
Of course.
We just had, in May, we had our online retreat. We shortened the days. It was 4 days. And in December, we have another one online. Okay. And in April of 2022, we'll be back on site. Yes, fingers crossed.
Where is on site?
On site is going to be in Louisiana. Okay. We're going to start there. We're going to eventually go to a slave plantation called the Whitney Plantation in Edgard, Louisiana, and have the participants actually walk on those hollowed grounds. It's a sugar plantation. And so you see a tremendous amount of vats. And John Cummings, who is a white man from Louisiana, an attorney who bought the plantation and poured millions of dollars into it so that it could be reclaimed as a slave representation of the enslaved Africans who came there. And he hired a person named Dr. Abraham Seck, who is an anthropologist from Senegal. And he began to unearth names and histories of who were there. So it's a powerful experience for the participants to walk on those grounds. And so that's where we're going to be housed, at least for in April. We're looking to go to the Gullah Islands. We're looking to go to the Peace and Justice Museum in Montgomery, and possibly just being housed in North Carolina, and then go down there for another sojourn. So we've got these ideas to do. We don't take a lot of people. You know, 15 to 20 is our really maximum for on-site as well as online. But the results have been this. People have said that they didn't know until they actually called in their ancestors, saw their pictures, brought their names in, how interconnected they were with who their ancestors were, how they walked, how they lived, how they breathed.
Yeah.
One gentleman from our last retreat said, I really wasn't wanting to do this one exercise called the genogram that really tracks, maps your family history. And once I did, I recognized that I'm from a long line of people who've abandoned, men who abandoned. And then I started to look at myself.
Mm.
What were the patterns that were lying within me?
Well,
another person who one evening was up until 1 o'clock in the morning researching through Ancestry because she had two names and she wanted to go deeper because now she wanted to know.
Yeah.
And from that, she began to feel the healing of herself. This is the possibility that we work with. That we can actually lay this groundwork for people to unearth what is not pretty and messy. And we talk about that. This is not going to be easy.
Yeah. Is there any follow-up, Nolly Way? Like if somebody does this, I can also imagine kind of a re-traumatization happens.
Yeah.
And along with the healing, there's this re-traumatization that could also happen. I'm wondering what kind of follow-up is there that people have to...
We have tremendous resources we've given them, as well as being able to reconnect. Because what we do in these is retreats is we are creating a community.
Okay.
A community of people who have like-mindedness, but also a common language now. So they're able to reconnect. And then we have reunions and a place where now online, because everything is online, we're able to gather people together and we give them little snippets of opportunities to reimagine if they have forgotten, to remember what the retreat was about.
Yeah.
And we want to begin to do that on a quarterly basis. And then pretty soon, the next retreat, we'll have another 15, and then we'll have another 15. And the beautiful thing is we are planning a program called the Alumni Program.
Okay.
So those who have gone through deep time liberation can then enroll into the alumni program. And that program will take them to a different journey, which we will actually have them staying on a plantation, sleeping there. And in that particular modality, we will be looking at that next step to healing, and that's forgiveness.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not forgiveness of the oppressor or anyone who's on that land, but it's forgiveness of self and the conditions that we have been beset with.
Yeah.
And looking at the rage and the anger that's still possibly lying within us.
Yeah.
So that's the alumni program that hopefully people who've gone through deep time liberation will be able to join in with.
So Nolly Way, how has this work impacted you as a Dharma teacher? How is your has your teaching changed?
It has. It has. I am finding ways to now integrate and weave in the sense of 2,500 years of Buddhist cosmology with 400 years of an enslaved narrative to an ancestry and a land that goes back from the beginning of humankind.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I'm able to weave that in and look at what is contemporary in our lives. Because when I now teach the Dharma, I'm teaching it from this woven place of how does 2,500 years ago connect with now? How does that connect with you? so that people are not just walking away with a theory or a principle, but they can actually apply it. What could be the antidotes that we can use today? How do we live our lives today, given these bodies? I just had a woman ask me, how do you deal with greed, hatred, and delusion as a Black woman?
Mm. And your answer was?
It was vast. It was vast.
We'll talk about it afterwards.
Yeah, we're talking. Yeah, because because we're always asking that. And I'm honest.
Sometimes how is it different? How is that suffering of when we talk about Buddhist principles of greed, hatred, and delusion as Black people in this country, when the Dharma is talking about greed, hatred, and illusion, and particularly Western convert Buddhism, they're looking at primarily in this country, white bodied people who are Dharma practitioners and Dharma teachers. And so, you know, they're healing that. Is that the same thing that we need? Is that the same?
It isn't. Because if you're driving in a car, as this one particular example was, I'm driving in a car and a policeman's behind me, I can feel what's arising in me. I'm already adverse, right? That's a condition, right? And what is that relationship now that you have? And what then is the story you tell yourself, whether the cop car goes right around you?
Right.
You're still impacted.
You're impacted. That's right. The whole nervous system has just gone through a whole thing.
Right.
Yeah.
And so how do you then, quote unquote, be with it?
Yeah.
When you've actually had the visceral feeling.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And you actually, for me, as I spoke to, you've got to understand what that sensation is like.
Yeah.
And how that sensation then reacted with your mind telling you the story.
That's right.
And how do you, and the difference is that reaction.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so it's bigger and it's more vast than all of that, but it is different. When you have had an oppressive state around you for most of your life, if not all of your life. I am well into this next chapter of my life at this point. And so I am constantly aware of what has happened, what is present, and what I am doing now with this work is to really begin to lay the groundwork for future generations.
Yeah.
So that they know. You know, I have a grandson who's 4. I want him to know who his people are. You know, what did we have to endure and what did we survive? And how are we resilient and joyful?
Yeah.
So that he, much like the wheel of samsara, at some point, you know, with dependent origination, even you have to cut it somewhere, whether it's an impact or becoming or whatever that might be. We have an opportunity for future generations to stop the cycle of our internal oppression.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
By knowing, witnessing, bearing witness to our ancestral history and to the trauma that besets us as well. What a gift we have.
Yeah. What a gift we have in you, Noli Way. You're kind heart, your tender, kind heart. It's just, it leads in everything you do. And I feel so honored to, you know, journey next to you and have you as my friend and my colleague and my teacher. And it's so beautiful to see this manifestation of you and your peers. And I know it's not just, you know, you've got a team and I honor that team. And I just want to say, I'm so, so grateful for who you are and the tenderness that you bring to everything, you know? And like you just said, I mean, you're at the whatever part of your life journey you're on, but those that are coming, you're doing this work for those that are coming.
Yeah.
And I think about Calvin, your grandson, right? Look at that smile that he puts on your face. I have to say his name.
Yeah, he's and for his children.
Yeah, and his children and his children's
right,
children.
Right, exactly, exactly. I just want to say one last thing. As we heal from these traumatic experiences of our past, mm-hmm. We begin to do this work for future generations, we're actually also healing the ancestors who couldn't.
Yeah.
And I really want to make that clear. We are not doing this alone.
Right.
We are being held, pushed, loved, supported all the way. My back is being held up by Nana and those greens and that monkey bread.
There you go. There you go.
And by my dad and those oxtails and my mom with her laugh.
Yeah.
I'm being held up by my ancestors.
Yeah.
So, and right there. If they couldn't speak their own truth, let me be the one to do it for them.
Yes. You have that opportunity. You have all the resources. You have everything you need to be that liberating voice for them. And you're doing that. And that is exactly too. So it's those who are coming and those who have come before us. We are speaking that truth for them.
Yeah. And this is deep time liberation.
That's what deep time liberation is. Deep time liberation is such an appropriate name.
Yeah.
I want to also offer to folks your two very, very impressive websites that I love.
Thank you.
I love being on your websites. Deep Time Liberation is deeptimelib.org, deeptimelib.org. And Peace at Any Pace website is just peaceatanypace.org. Peace at any pace, PACE.org. Malizwe.
I knew that was coming. I knew
it was coming.
I know.
I have to help myself. Malizwe, I love you dearly.
I love you, Conda. Thank you for this opportunity to talk about what is now opening my heart.
Yeah.
And really calling forth this work.
Beautiful. And I hope on your websites there's a place where people can reach you if they want to talk to you, or if there's resources that they have that they want to help you resource your work.
Yes.
That opportunity is there to help resource this work.
Thank you. And I want to say that we offer these programs to people pretty much for free because those who need it may not be able to afford it.
Right.
And as we move into the Elder Project, we're going to be offering that for free, and the youth and young adult program as well. So we are a nonprofit really looking for funding and people who can align themselves to this mission.
Yeah.
You know, it's not esoteric. It's not out there. It's really grassroots on the ground. Let's heal.
Yeah.
Let's do this work together. So
one person at a time.
One person at a time. So it's really great to be able to offer it in the ways that we are.
That's so beautiful. Even more beautiful. There's no price that can get in the way of somebody wanting to attend this.
Yeah. Yeah. Beautiful. So I'm excited about that.
Thank you, Ms. Conda.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for being with me this day and just, you know, spilling yourself to audience and opening your heart and your beautiful smile and your just your heart is so beautiful. Thank you, Noli.
You're welcome. All right, sweet one.
All right. You be well, okay? We'll see you around the way.
Yes. Hopefully in Alexandria, Louisiana.
Please. Yeah. Please.
I want to come. Yeah.
Come.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. What would you like to get off your chest? Are you holding on to secrets, fears, or frustrations? We all carry around different stressors, both big and small. Don't keep it all bottled up inside. Therapy is a safe space to get things off your chest and work through whatever is weighing you down. It's also a great way to learn to resolve conflict, change negative thought patterns, and more. If you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online and designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Get it off your chest with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/BeHereNow today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.com/BeHereNow.